Shalom, shalom, shalom. Baruchim abeim. Welcome to Awakening Torah Musar Mindfulness, our weekly public offering from the Institute for Holiness, Hamakon LaKedusha, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. I am Rabbi Chasya Uriel Steinbauer, the founder and director of the Institute for Holiness. And you are joining us today on Wednesday, December 20th, 2023. And the date in the Hebrew calendar is the 8th of Tevet of the year Tafshin Pei Daled, which is 5784. We are a little bit behind, and I'll take full responsibility for that. The war and the coping from the genocide in Israel of October 7th and the carrying the pain of our people, the response of trying to bring back those who were kidnapped has had an enormous effect on all of us, including myself, including my institute, where it's difficult on a day-to-day basis to not only follow through, but to get things necessarily done on time, which is, as you know, is part of Israeli culture, was already a challenge. So just to acknowledge, we are covering the Shabbat from Saturday, December 9th, the Parshat Vayeshev, okay? That was done on Kaf Vav of Kislev, of Tavshin Pei Dalet. So we're going to cover Vayeshev, and then this week, Bezrat Hashem, before Shabbat, that's my hope, with God's help, we will cover Miketz, which was from last Shabbat. So I thank you for your patience. I'm delighted from all the people that are looking forward to this offering. I thank you for your emails and your comments. You're welcome to join us live right now on Facebook or on our YouTube channel. Please do subscribe there. And you'll also catch us, of course, at our website at www.kehilatmusar.com. You'll go to the blog section and you'll find both the audio and the video for this weekly offering. So for those of you new to us, what is this weekly offering? It's where we look at the weekly Torah portion in the Jewish tradition. Essentially, it's part of the Hebrew Bible, but the five books of Moshe, that is broken up throughout the whole year. We are in the book of Bereshit, and we are now on the Parshat Vayeshev, which is, what sitting would that be for us? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It is our 9th sitting of the year. What do I mean by sitting? We basically spend some time looking at a section of the text of how we can apply what we learn there to our practice of Musar mindfulness on the path. And we then engage in a mindfulness meditation together in order to practice. Also, if you've been following or you're new, this whole year is dedicated to responding to the grief and loss of the genocide that happened on October 7th here in Israel. And the ongoing capture and captivity of those who were kidnapped in Israel that were taken into Gaza, that we're still waiting for and praying for. And obviously the ongoing war where we're losing soldiers, where there are many people who are at risk, and the whole situation obviously is heartbreaking. For some of us, there is just coping. For some of us, there is ongoing recovery and healing, depending on where you're located in Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, and even the non-Jewish people, our allies, who are always here to learn with us and support this institute and the practice of Musar mindfulness. So we always begin with our kavanot, our intentions for today's practice. I'm going to go ahead and share screen for those of you with vision or who are watching by video. If you are joining us on podcasts, on audio, or do not have vision, you'll hear me read out these kavanot, these intentions for today. So we see this about an hour together pochot or yoter, less or more, as a time of radical self-care that we're engaging in learning and practice together. We're doing this to strengthen our own souls in order to be a benefit to others in the future. We're also doing this to strengthen our relationship with others. It's like this threefold path, right? Strengthening the self as being our own best friend, strengthening our relationship with others, and our relationship with the divine. So we're doing this to strengthen our relationship to others so we can be a better conduit of God's good to others when they need us. We're also strengthening our relationships to the divine, again, so we can be this conduit of God's good to others when they need us. It's very important. So I'm going to stop sharing screen so that you're aware of what I'm doing, whether on audio or video. And we're going to enter. So how do I do this? I share with you a brief summary of this Torah portion, and then I'm going to hone in on what we think we need to bring into light, the Musar and the mindfulness of this Torah portion, particularly the midot, the soul traits that are operating among our ancestors in the text that they have so kindly passed down to us. Okay, so what happens in Vayeshev? Our ancestor, Patriarch Yaakov, second in line after Avraham. No, third in line. Whew! Shows you what hour it is here. It is late. Third in line. He is the son of Yitzhak. He is the grandson to Avraham. He gives Yosef, who is up until about now in the Torah, he is his youngest son. But then he has another son, Binyamin. Okay? Yosef, he gives him a katonet pasim. What does that mean? It's beautiful. It's a beautiful fine shirt or coat, most likely with stripes. He gives this to him and not his other sons. This ends up causing jealousy in the brothers, and the brothers begin to feed off of that jealousy, and they hate him. They hate their little brother, who is a teenager by now. Yosef dreams, so Yosef, this teenager among this family, he dreams his brother's bundles of wheat bow down to his in a dream. Now, to understand dreams back in that culture, they're huge. They're basically considered akin to prophecy, or at least somewhat a prophecy, taken very seriously in ancient Near East culture. So his brothers are going to take it seriously. They're not going to just assume, oh, it's just a dream, the way we might think of it today, or some of us. So he dreams that his brother's bundles of wheat are bowing down to him, and that the sun, the moon, and 11 stars are bowing down to him. Two different dreams. He tells his brothers. We're going to look at wise speech, or the lack of it, during this Torah portion. He tells his brothers, and the brothers' reactivity is to hate him even more. They practice ill will. So I want to be very clear here in my language that I don't think Yosef is causing the reactivity that the brothers are choosing. Okay, they have their own free will and responsibility. It doesn't mean he still doesn't have negative behavior or behavior that's going to have consequences, a cause and effect. But never should we blame Yosef, right, for the reactivity of the brothers and acting out on it. Okay, so they obviously are having jealousy arise. Now they're having ill will and hate arise. Okay, that is their own responsibility. A lot of people blame Yosef, the younger brother. So Yaakov then sends Yosef to check on his brothers. They had gone off with the sheep. They were all shepherds. They're out shepherding. And when they see him approaching, what's the reactivity that arises? The ultimate form of ill will. They plot to kill him. Reuven, who is the eldest, and therefore in that position, needs to take on the authority of the patriarch while they're out. Reuven persuades very strongly. We might take a look at that language. Persuades the others to throw Yosef into a pit instead of killing him. Yehuda, who I believe is the fourth or sixth born, I have to count. He proposes to sell him into slavery. Yosef is then sold to traders passing by and is taken to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, as a slave. So what do the brothers do? They kill, murder, if you will, kill a goat. They dip Yosef's ketonet pasim in goat's blood, the beautiful jacket that his father had given him. And they show up to their father and ask him to identify the jacket, right? They show it to Yaakov, who believes that now Yosef was killed by a wild animal. In Egypt, in Mitzrayim, Yosef is sold to Potiphar. He's an important member of Paro's court, of the Pharaoh's court. And then, as if it can't get like more full, what do we call it again from Jon Kabat-Zinn, our wonderful teacher, full catastrophe living. Potiphar's wife falsely accuses Yosef of attacking her, attempting to rape her, essentially. And Yosef is sent to jail, okay, into a boor, which we have to remember he was in a boor when his brothers threw him into one. While in jail, Yosef meets Paro's baker and cupbearer. Both of them have dreams, again, back to dreams. And Yosef interprets them. He says it's God interpreting them. He's just the messenger. And he predicts that the baker will be killed and the cupbearer will return to Paro's service. This all comes true, and Yosef is left in prison for 2 more years. So that is our summary of what's going on in the story portion. Obviously, too much to discuss and talk about everything. So what is it that we want to focus on that's very important to our practice? Okay. And I want to see if I had any more summary for you that was important for you to understand the background. All I really want to point out is that the importance of the story of Yosef, which take up four different Torah portions, is that it really initiates a chain of events that will lead to not only his physical body being in Egypt, but then his family, his extended family of 70 souls, and then the whole Jewish people, okay? And it's really the prelude to the whole story of oppression and redemption that constitute the overriding motif of biblical theology. And his experience, essentially, is a series of episodes set into motion, right? But how are they set into motion? If we've been paying attention to these parashiyot, and we'll continue to do so. The causes are often temporal, petty, sordid, and mundane. What, again, we call full catastrophe living, the just daily living as a human being, particularly among these families that are so imbalanced. And it's the father's favoritism. Again, that goes back to Avraham behaving that way. And then Yitzhak behaving that way towards Esav. And then Yaakov now is favoring a child. Okay, these have consequences. This is what we call the karma. This law that we see as foundational to the earth and the planet of cause and effect. There are consequences to our behavior. Maybe not in the immediate moment, but it eventually shows its face. So the father's favoritism, the tattletelling that essentially Yosef does as a teenager, which most children do, the sibling jealousy, and that just like the rotting of that at the soul level, the what some people read as like egotistical boyish dreams, but really this is just a boy who's having dreams and wants connection so desperately. He wants connection with his brothers and family. You can see that he lacks that, right? So when we lack that and we also lack the skill, we often acted out in inappropriate ways. And so he's trying to connect through these dreams, It's often see done without wise speech, wise discernment, maybe even wise intention, although I don't think much intention's there at all. And it goes awry, it goes wrong. Okay, so we can have the ultimate beautiful love heart intention to connect, and we go about it the wrong way. And he does it by kind of vomiting speech. He does it by just sharing these dreams, telling too much, telling it just, this is just his whole thing. All of these are elements of a family situation that accumulates into an explosive tragedy, not only for the boy, but the family and our people that we still recount every year, right? At Pesach, at Passover. But all year, we have this reminder in our prayers, God taking us out of Egypt. This is all a part of it. So I want that as the background for you to be aware of what's going on. So let's move in. I want us to keep in mind from the previous behavior of the patriarchs, Avraham, Yitzhak, and now Yaakov and his son Yosef, that in every generation and every time they're together, like the stories and what is shared, there is deception there. And that deception basically rots away the foundation of trust and connection in the family. Even if the deception is done with God's approval or God's support or the mother's doing or support, or it has good intentions, or if it was meant to be. Deception is still a deception. And as our wonderful teacher, Nechama Leibowitz taught us a few weeks ago, even if it was meant to be and there was good intentions, the train wreck is still going to come in when you do it through deception. Okay, so there are consequences. And so we're witnessing this. We're witnessing how when there is deception that goes on, there's a certain defilement that happens in the hearts and even in the fabric of the society, of the family unit. And in biblical, in ancient Near East culture, it's very much a corruption of the environment. It's an outrage. Okay, it affects the earth and one's relationships to the divine and to each other. Okay, it affects the whole triangle. So, Yosef. Okay, let's take a look at this boy. We have to remember that he was probably around 17 years old. Okay, people have a lot of harsh judgment towards this boy. Moderns, right? Even our parshanim, our chazal, our rabbinic commentators. Okay, Yosef, he's considered a helper to his brothers who are older than him. He so badly wants to connect. You have to remember his father, Yaakov, was also 17 when he had to flee from behaving in deception with his mother towards his dying father, Yitzhak, and towards Esav. And so he fled also. He ends up being, his father, Yaakov, ends up being essentially almost like an eved, a slave. He was an indentured servant to Laban. And he ends up having to carry the burden of that deception in silence, essentially, for 20 years. Before he encounters his brother again. Now, Yosef, what happens to him? He ends up being thrown into a pit by his brothers who actually want to kill him. He then is sold into slavery. And we know from later on in the Torah that he was crying out in that bor, in that pit. It's probably one of the first times that he's using wise speech by crying out, because that crying out is probably going to haunt the conscience of his brothers who actually sat down to eat during this. He is sold into slavery. He lacks wise speech when he's that 17-year-old. There isn't a filter. It's like everything just comes out, whatever he thinks or dreams. He it starts off with the bad reports of his brothers. Then his father, Yisrael. Now you have to remember his name was changed, right? His name was changed by both the angel that he wrestled with, the angel man, and God. Called him Israel now. And this idea that hopefully that he was leaving that kind of sordid history that was tied to his name, Yaakov, of what how he treated his father and brother, hopefully for like a new way of being with Yisrael, right? With the name. Unfortunately, Yisrael decides to love Yosef best, loves one child best. You can already know this is a train wreck about to happen in front of you. So he couldn't escape his own unbalanced midot, even with the new name. It's something that we wish to happen when we take on new names. It's a big part of the Jewish tradition that sometimes people take on new names in order to reflect either aspirations for new behavior or even new behavior, a new path, right? Someone who wants to leave sin that was in the past that they took responsibility for, that they did teshuva for, right? So essentially, he then, the third thing that ends up happening is his father gives him this tunic, this ketonet pasim, which just adds fuel to the fire of the jealousy and the hatred. Then he shares these dreams instead of having a filter of maybe I shouldn't share these dreams or maybe I should consult my father first, right? And then he's sent out to his brothers pasteurizing. And where do they go to pasteurize? We have to remember that when Yaakov is fled from his brother and father, the responsibility of his behavior, he ends up in a place that where he has this dream, right? Again, dreams of the sulam, of the ladder, where the angels are going up and down. And that place where he ends up is what we associate as the place where the Akedat Yitzhak happens, where the almost slaughter of his father Yitzhak happened at the hand of Avraham, his grandfather. So it's the boy, the 17-year-old boy Yaakov, has to return or go to the place of trauma for his father to bear witness, to attempt to over time move through some form of recovery, healing, coping. And so we see the brothers, where are they have to pasture with the animals, right, with the sheep. They return to Shechem. What is Shechem? Shechem is where their sister Dina was kidnapped and essentially raped by the former prince there, Hamor, appropriately named Donkey. And the brothers, in response, her full blood brothers, Shimon and Levi, return to that Shechem, and they actually murder, as far as we know, all the boys and men of that town in response to how their sister was treated, which I covered in the previous Parshiot. You can go back and cover it there. So they're returning now to pasture, and the very place where they had committed murder, huge amount of people, might even been a genocide, who knows? I don't know if there was such a thing as Shechemites, of only people who resided in Shechem. But they return to that place of trauma, and they're out there, but they're not doing it to recover, and they're not doing it to heal. They're out there just doing their task of taking care of the sheep. And when they actually move on a little bit to another location, I believe it's Dothan. But the fact that when they see their brother, even though they were just in this place of unbelievable trauma, right? Where there was great grief and loss, even in response to their sister, Dina, right? They immediately have ill will arise to a point where it's at a frenzy and it's in that group think, and they decide, let's kill him. It's almost like being in the energy of that former tragedy, the former murder of all those people, instead of it being a place of honoring where that trauma took place and trying to heal, it fed that blood revenge, that blood vengeance. Okay, it's the exact opposite of what happens with Yaakov. So the only time we actually witness Yaakov having wise speech this whole Torah portion is when, and I'll try to share this a bit with you if I can pull up I have it here in Sepharia, the text. It's when the young boy, the 7-year-old Yosef, shares one of the dreams, right? He shares the dream. He told it to his fathers and brothers. So, right, we're in chapter 37 in Bereshit, in Genesis, and we're at Pasuk 10, so verse 10. Vayesaper el aviv echav, right? So what when he told it to his father and his brothers, what does his father do? Vayig arbo aviv. His father berated him. It's like, oh, what are you doing? This dream is awful. Why are you telling this to us? What do you intend, right? So he goes on, vayomer lo, and he says to him, this is his father speaking. He says, Mahachalom haze asher chalamta? What is this dream you have dreamed? Havo navo ani ve'imecha ve'achecha? Do you intend, right? Have you come here, right? Are we to come? I, your mother and your brothers, and do what? Lechish tachavot lecha arza? Do you intend for us to bow low to you, to the ground? So it's the first time. The first time that you see Yaakov using wise speech and even speaking in the moment, right? We're used to him be just shutting down. He's a man of silence, right? He doesn't speak when he should, not until he blows up at Laban later on. It's almost like he inherited the trauma of his father, Yitzhak, who survived almost being slaughtered by his father, Avraham. So he comes down the mountain, can't speak. He raises a son that he doesn't even love. He loves Esav more because he feeds him game. He doesn't talk much. Obviously, they don't talk much. And so poor Yaakov, who has to flee, has not learned the skill of how to fight, of how to have a disagreement, of how to have an argument, of how to take responsibility for his behavior. Okay, so we're noticing when there's a lack of skill around wise speech, then there's a lack of skill of taking responsibility. Okay, so let's look at my notes and move on here. So what is tied to deception and unwise speech is something very important in the Jewish tradition, which I'm sure by now you've heard other people talk about, which is this idea of seeing clearly. Right? Lehakir, to recognize, right? And when we have unwise seeing, when we're not seeing clearly, then we don't recognize, we don't see someone fully, which is so important in the Jewish tradition. God comes down, for instance, at Sodom and Gomorrah to check out what's going on, to see what's happening before God acts. So if God does this, all the more so, we are to see clearly, check out what's going on, and move forward, right? So essentially, Yosef being sent there by his father and even himself, obviously are not seeing clearly the hostility and jealousy and the growing hatred towards Yosef by the brothers. And they're ignoring it. They're ignoring the growing hostility. And you have to remember that Yaakov fled from the hostility of Esav. He never got to face and see and recognize the face of Esav and see the pain he had caused. He fled. He ran around. He never managed to build those skills and develop the emotional intelligence that's needed to recognize anger and when it's getting out of control, and how to have reconciliation in the moment. Instead, it has to happen 20 years later. This is the same thing here with Yosef and even Yaakov, who sends him to go check on the brothers who are shepherding, who are out to pasture. They don't see it. They don't fully see and recognize their brothers, right? And this happens throughout the whole relationship. When they see him, when the brothers see Yosef, and all they can see is who they really hate, which is the father, because they hate that the father loves him more and favors him. So they project it onto the very vulnerable and innocent 17-year-old boy, the easy target. All they can see is what they hate, which is the father image inside, the coat that he's wearing. They can't recognize and see him fully. They're not really coming down and doing wise seeing like God does in the Torah and what we are expected to do. They only see what they want to see, and that is what they hate. And so when you objectify someone like that, when you don't see them, you can throw them into a pit. You can hear their cries and go and sit down and have a meal. You can sell them into slavery. Even next, coming up in Miketz, which we'll do Bezrat Hashem soon, this week, when they come down to Egypt for a famine, they don't recognize their brother, Yosef. They don't see him. They don't recognize him. And it might be because we have all sorts of excuses. How can that be? He's 30 years old now, later on in the story, Miketz, Yosef. He looks like an Egyptian. He's totally shaven. He doesn't look like an Israelite. He doesn't look like a Hebrew. Doesn't look like a Jew. He's wearing all the garb of an Egyptian. So of course they can't see him. They can't see and recognize that this is Yosef. I don't think that's only it, right? Plenty of us have siblings or family who completely go out into life and completely change how they look, and we still see them and still recognize them. Okay, so let's just hold that in mind for Miketz later. All right, so the brothers, woo! And why are the brothers not seeing clearly, right? Not seeing Yosef fully, the 17-year-old boy. They are so lost in their reactivity, in their delusion, and their frenzied intensity, right? The hatred that even leads them to do an unbelievable act among our ancestors in the Jewish tradition in the ancient Near East, which is you never desecrate a body. You don't throw it in the pit, in the boar, to leave it, right? Where it won't have a proper burial, where the father will not be able to see the son's body and bury it, which ties so much to why there is so much reactivity that we're trying to practice and work around. When Hamas and the Palestinians kidnapped and took our people and not returning them, and also what they did and during the massacre, right, the genocide of October 7th, what they burned people completely, where we can't even identify them, where people were maimed and tortured, we can't recognize them, we don't have bodies to bury. This ties to this portion very much so. And when we get to the point where we are in a frenzied intensity, right? Intensity of hatred, of ill will and delusion, we will not be able to see clearly. We will not be able to recognize. And we don't want to go there. We want to practice, okay? So even though we are in so much pain and in shock over how we were treated and how we continue to be treated, right? This crazy ongoing war that is causing so much harm and suffering, right? We must not succumb to what our ancestors, the rest of the brothers, did. We must not. And if we do, we have to face those consequences, which will be a practice long term. Remember, this is about grief and loss. This is about us facing that it is going to be a long road of coping and possibly healing and recovery, depending on where we live, who's involved, and where we are. So let's move on in our teaching. So we want to look at what behavior, God give us a blue map of what we need to do here. It's very, very important to pay attention to this. What kind of behavior interferes with ill will and delusion of the brothers, right? Of their hatred and delusion. Reuven, right? Reuven jumps up. Kill the boy. His language is so intense and so important. I don't know if I have quick access to it because I don't want to take more time in this, but look very closely at the language of Reuven here, okay? Because it's where he jumps into his real responsibility and role as the patriarch in when the patriarch's not there. He has to take over, right? So let's see here. What does he say here? He says very clearly, here we are, Pasuk 21, again in chapter 37. He says right here, when Reuven heard it, he tried to save him from them, right? Okay, Vayishma Reuven, Vayatzilehu mi yadam. Okay, tries to save him from their blood. Okay, that's the real language. He says, Vayomer, lo nakenu nafesh, which we translate as, let us not take a life. The language here is actually very, very strong. He's basically saying, don't you dare touch that boy. We will not be doing such a thing, right? He goes on to even use another tactic, shed no blood, right? Don't you dare. This is not happening. Instead, so then he gives him another offer. Cast him into the pit, but don't touch him yourself, right? We can go all into sorts of things. Did Reuven do the right thing? Should he have stood up even more? That's not part of the discussion here. But what it requires is vigilance, such strong vigilance. Reuven is on top of it. He's aware. Talk about recognizing and seeing clearly. Reuven in this moment is like, woo! They're in a frenzied hate. They're in that group think. They want to kill this, my youngest brother. This is crazy. We're not going to take his life. Done. It's off the table. Right? And so he seems to kind of, he has this vigilance at first to make sure that this actual murder doesn't happen. And then they go to sit down. And after they rip off his coat and they throw him into this pit, they go to sit down at a meal, right? And Reuven seems to go off then, okay? He stops being vigilant. This is really important to learn. So first, what kind of behavior interferes with ill will and delusion that's leading to possible murder through vengeance and revenge? It's this really decisive statement that will tolerate no opposition. We do not behave this way. We will not be doing this, right? It's that vigilance. Then all of a sudden, what are we taught? Reuven goes off. I guess he doesn't think he needs to continue to be vigilant, sadly. So Yosef is crying from the pit. He is ignored. There are no pleas heard, right? Yehuda, through greed, decides that he wants to make some money off of this young brother being in the pit. He goes on to say, right, this, you could just imagine this going on. So you have to look at next who comes to witness this and benefit from the exile of this boy. And it's his extended family. It is the Ishmaelites come. Okay. If just to remind you who Ishmael is, he is the son to Abraham, our first patriarch, not to Sarah, but to Hagar. He is, they are coming, and that is who his brothers sell to the Ishmaelites Yosef, as far as we know. Okay. They sell him to the Ishmaelites. They're planning to. Then we hear that Midianite traders pass by. It's this whole thing. The rabbis are trying to figure out who did he get really sold by? Was it the Ishmaelites, the Midianites? Who's being sold? We only know that Reuven didn't continue with his vigilance, which needed to stay there and actually monitor, unfortunately, which just shows us how important it is that we stay present and monitor. This is going to be important for us after Bezrat Hashem, this war, even during. We're going to need to be very clear, decisive statements that what we will tolerate and what we won't. No opposition, that's it. And that we remain completely vigilant. Reuven returns to the pit. He goes to check on Yosef and he's gone. And he rents his clothing. He goes into mourning. Cannot believe the boy is gone. He loses it because he knows that he is now the patriarch when the patriarch's not there. And this is it. It's the train has come in to face the consequences, right? At least that's how he fears and what he goes. So before we go on, the brothers, when they take the poor boy's coat, his katona pasim, they kill a goat to cover his tunic in blood, so that they can then hand the tunic to their father and say, do you recognize this? Well, knowing fully, of course, he's going to recognize it because it's the coat he gave him and didn't give to any of the other brothers, right? Now, when did the last time we see somebody use a goat just to the very man that they hand the bloody jacket to? Yaakov was covered by goat hair and skin by his mother in order to deceive his father, Yitzhak, to go in and feel like and smell like Esau. So the goat, it was used for deception there. The goat is used for deception here. And I love, actually, just to bring a quick source here to what Aviva Zornberg says about the whole goat thing. She says, the brother's crime remains throughout Jewish history as a kind of ineradicable original sin. We sacrifice a goat for all communal sin offerings in the temple. That the goat that was substituted for Yosef remains a symbol of hatred and violence in the consciousness of the whole people, which is so interesting on so many levels, because goats are just, if you know anything about goats, they're just so beautiful creatures. So to be used this way. So deception. We even see later on Tamar, who was supposed to be married to one of Yehuda's sons. She was first married to Er, then Onan, and then she's supposed to be married to Shelah. She ends up having to deceive her father-in-law, Yehuda, in order to have intercourse with him, sleep with him. And she conceives twins through that process. There's deception there. It's just this ongoing deception, right? It was actually Yehuda, just to go back, who was the one that suggested to sell Yosef to slavery. So he deceives Reuven and his father by letting them not know that he was sold into slavery. And in some ways, Yehuda was even deceiving his own son, Shelah, by not being forthright and honest about who Tamar was, and that he was expected to marry her. But anyway, back to this concept of how are we going to use this? How are we going to use this as a practice? I want to remind you that Yosef, and we'll see this in Miketz coming up, but even before that, he does mature from 17 to 30. He develops less of a reptilian brain and more of the executive brain and starts to lehakir. starts to recognize. He starts to see people fully. He's able to see their emotions. He sees the baker. He sees the cupbearer. He sees their pain when they wake up with those dreams that they had and they couldn't interpret them. He cares about them. As other human beings, he says, "What's bothering you? Tell me your dreams. Let me interpret them." He wants to help. He's finally getting the connection that he wanted all along from his brothers, and he didn't know how to help them appropriately. You know, he helped in the way that often children do with reptilian brains, you know, by tattletaling, going to the father and saying, "The brothers are doing this." But really, he so desperately wants to connect with them and be useful, to be in relationship with them. Even the dreams were that. The sharing of the dreams were, "I want to be useful to you. I'm dreaming that I'm going to rule over you, but I'm going to be useful to you." That's what he's saying. "I want to be seen. I want to connect. I want to feel worthy and loved among you, and not just favored by my father who projects onto me because of the death of his wife, Rachel." Okay, these children are so often manipulated and used through what the adults can't really practice and work out. And that's not us. We don't want to be that. Our ancestors have handed down with God these amazing stories to us so that we may learn from them and try to grow in practice, be less of the reptilian brain and more of the executive brain. So with that, I don't think there was anything more I wanted to share with you from my notes. I think I did everything. We're going to move into our mindfulness meditation practice. Yeah, we're not. It's amazing what when you are in trauma and trying to survive even on a foreign land, sold as a slave, what you have to do, right, to survive what you're going through. So think about when Yosef is finally brought in to interpret the dreams of Paro, what he has to do. And he has to shave and cut all his hair off, put on clothing. I mean, the things that we have to do to survive certain situations. It reminds me actually of the latest picture and video of the three older men, our people that are captives in Gaza, where they're making them, they framed the Palestinians, Hamas, they framed their beards the way they demand and expect certain Muslim men to wear them. And this is not obviously by choice. This is someone who has to respond in the moment. So we'll see that we'll see that in Miketz when next time, when basically it ends up being Yosef's liberation, excuse me, in the boar in prison and rise to power. So with that, before we move on into our practice, find yourself in a seated, comfortable position. If you're like me, come to the edge of your chair so that you're upright, okay, but not West Point stiff, as John Kabat-Zinn teaches us. You want to feel at ease, but also awake and alert, which seems paradoxical, but this is the practice. I'm going to open us with a small teaching before we go into the meditation. So you settle into your posture that's supportive for your practice during this time. You may wish to close your eyes if you have vision, or to keep your gaze rested on the table in front of you or the floor. Really bringing what we call the beginner's mind, which means a mind that's open and curious to the posture and to the felt sense of the body in this moment, which is a unique moment. Every moment is a new opportunity, a new moment. So Rabbi Yeruchim Levowitz teaches that during every event, circumstance that happens in our lives, we have an opportunity to keep our focus on growth and not serenity. Meaning, we ask ourselves, what type of person am I after this has happened? Judaism sees every circumstance and event as a possible nisayon, as a possible test from God. So he says, how did I do on this test? Did I pass it in an elevated manner? This comes from the As Torah on Bereshit, page 222. This will not sit well for many of us today, surviving this genocide, ongoing captivity, and the war, to see what has happened to us and what continues to happen, the unfolding as a test from God. So if this doesn't sit with you, and maybe even it sits offensively to you, there still is the opportunity in the long, long run when you are ready to be able to still ask yourself the question of what type of person, who was I on October 6th? And who was I on October 7th, 8th, and every day after? Did I behave in alignment with my values as much as I could? Of course, if we're caught up in trauma and reactivity because of the trauma and the grief and loss, then there is very little, if any, space between the match and the fuse. We're not able yet to have that same sense of free will to choose and act. But each day, as that window begins to open, as we're working on coping, and then we're maybe working on healing a little bit or some form of recovery, we will begin to ask, am I behaving in alignment with my values in an elevated manner? And that's what Rav Yeruchem is inviting us to do. Now, as I said, some of us are going to be able to do that much sooner and easier than others, like for those who in the diaspora, meaning Chutz La'aretz, outside of Israel, who obviously are facing such rises in anti-Semitism, Jewish hatred, Israel hatred, anti-Zionism, that frenzy, that ill will, that delusion, that not seeing clearly and fully, that comes with it its own reactivity and sense of grief and loss, and for some people, trauma, particularly those of us who come from families who survived the Shoah, the Holocaust. So some of us will be ready to enter those questions suggested that we seek to learn from what has happened. Each day is an opportunity. And some of us will not be ready to do this for a very long time, if ever. And that's okay. So letting the sensations of the body be met with a fresh awareness and sensitivity. Where are you right now? Are you here with me in my voice and your breath? What does it feel like in your body? I encourage the practice of grounding as part of really what can support us with sensitivity and responsiveness of heart. That means a real rooting of the feet into the ground held by the earth, feeling the weight of the sit bones, the heavier the better, really weighted. I'm taking time now to linger with sensations of the contact with the floor, with whatever you're sitting on, patiently trusting the heaviness of the limbs. Patiently trusting the body's weight in the chair, the body's uprightness and alignment, the verticality, God carrying us and holding us, grounded in the midst of heaven and earth, right here and right now. Sensing again how these orientations to grounding and to uprightness support a spacious sensitivity. Spacious sensitivity to the field of sensation that we call the body. Allowing your awareness to even be wider than that, if you're able, more open. We're going to invite in what are known as the Brahmaviharas, which are also Midot in the Musar tradition. Those of Chesed, Metta, loving kindness or friendliness. Simcha, appreciative joy. Rachamim, compassion. And Menuchat HaNefesh, equanimity. As we move through each of the Brahmaviharas, these Midot, in turn, with the encouragement to feel the particular orientation of each of the four, the way that they're going to shape our consciousness and experience to help us through this grief and loss to be here coping, healing, 1 minute at a time. Beginning with the practice of chesed, of metta, of loving kindness, of goodwill, the opposite of ill will. This is the default attitude that we want to encourage and cultivate as our way of meeting the world, knowing full well that when evil and hostility come at you in war, it'll be perhaps even unhealthy, not wise seeing and wise intention and discernment to have the attitude of facing the world this way, particularly those who come to do harm and suffering. But the minute that they have left the immediate trauma, the immediate genocide, as we sit and stand and practice, we want to slowly allow the awareness to tune in that cultivation of goodwill, of friendliness, of chesed towards ourselves, towards those we love and care most about, that we are caring for during this time. We may even say the word chesed, loving kindness, goodwill, friendly ease, kindness, a sense of warmth, a sense of basic goodwill. Meeting the arising experience of whatever arises in the body of this moment, the sounds, the thoughts, the images and moods, meeting it all with a basic goodwill that allows us to be here and allows us to know that whatever arises comes, has a certain shelf life, and will pass. If you are experiencing difficulty in body, mind, soul, spirit, remembering to quietly say to yourself, loving kindness in the midst of this, goodwill in the midst of this, kind in the midst of this, friendly in the midst of this. So important that you cultivate that goodwill towards yourself as part of healing, of coping with the grief and loss. You can only be your own best friend. No one else can do this work for you. Feeling into the particular tone and shaping quality of metta, of chesed, what it brings to your consciousness and to the world of the moment. As we move into the second of these midot, of these Brahma Viharas, these orientations, we move into simcha, appreciative joy. And we might be thinking, I can't. There's no joy here. We will begin to sense that these midot and orientations and intentions are not separate. They are aspects of each other and dimensions of our heart's potential. So encouraging and cultivating a sense of appreciation, which we could see as more of the joy of just appreciating that I am alive, I have made it, I have another day. We might quietly whisper to ourselves, appreciating this moment. Appreciating our family and everything they've done for us. Appreciating our Am, our people, and everything they've done for us. Appreciating our soldiers, everything they have done and continue to do for us. Appreciating the joy of those who were returned home to us. Appreciating the courage and strength of those who are still held, kidnapped in captivity. Sensing any receptivity, moments of breathing, moments of, can I be okay with this? Moments of okayness. Wellness present in the places of the body, the sense of opportunity in this practice right now. What can I appreciate? Letting the intention change again to the orientation and mida of compassion, of rachamim, to the sense of caring, of tenderness towards our suffering and the difficulty in the present moment. Maybe you sense in the body discomfort or fatigue. I know I do. Maybe you sense in the heart echoes, presence of moods and emotions that are associated with difficulty and unpleasantness. Inclining ourselves towards compassion with these phrases that we will whisper quietly to ourselves. I care about my difficulty. I care about my suffering. May I meet my suffering with kindness, with compassion, with tenderness. May this strengthen me to meet your suffering with kindness, with compassion, with tenderness. Breathing the sense of compassionate, tender care. As you sense the presence of difficulty or suffering in this moment, in this life. Now we invite the sense of the Mida and orientation toward equanimity, Menuchata Nefesh, which really translates as a real calmness, a real being able to reside in a menucha, like a nap, a resting in, a pausing of the soul. It's what I like to call centeredness. It's that real centered feeling of my neshama, my soul is centered, able to respond. Right? So we renew our connection and appreciation for the ground right now. The sense of support of the seat or cushion or bed underneath you. Perhaps you feel a coolness or uprightness in this dignified posture, showing you that you are created in the image and likeness of the divine. The gesture, the cultivation of menuchata nefesh, of equanimity, is a gesture of allowing. It's a gesture of opening, of expansion. Allowing things to be right here and right now. Can I do that? Am I able to do that? Breathing with the changing experience in inhalation and exhalation. The gift of oxygen from God. Allowing your breath to fall to its own natural rhythm. No need to brace against your breath. No need to control it. And now we quietly whisper to ourselves in this cultivation, changing, changing, allowing, allowing, being with, being with. And the reflection and cultivation that this too will change, this too will pass, this too may be with us the rest of our lives, and it will be different for our children and grandchildren. We whisper to ourselves, may I accept the arising and passing of this moment. We can sense how these midot, how they constitute different possibilities, these Brahma Viharas, for responding to the conditions that we encounter right here and right now. At times, we may notice on this journey of coping and healing together that the heart may feel open and available, a sense of capacity for meeting the difficulties we encounter, the pain and suffering that we encounter within and without. But other times we may notice ourselves feeling overwhelmed, depleted, activated, triggered, contracted, knowing that taking refuge in community together in this practice, on this path, we can lean into the grounding. We can lean into the resourcing together. We can lean into what we know nourishes and soothes and eases in this practice of appreciation, bringing us to balance and a sense of having God supporting us and the ground under our feet, taking refuge in the path of the potential, taking refuge in God, taking refuge in the teachings and the practice and this path. Ah. These orientations are a way of responding appropriately to the conditions that we encounter in alignment with our values. So as we move throughout the rest of our day and our life, sensing in the body and the heart, the potential of these midot, these Brahma Viharas, the orientations, the potential of our intention. Sensing how inseparable and mutually dependent they all are together on the heart's potential. Of whether or not in this moment we can respond. Cultivating self-compassion. That is compassion towards others, eventually bringing God's good to others. Grounding, loving kindness, appreciation, compassion and care and equanimity. We will sit the next moment in silence before I ring the bells to take us out of the practice. Allowing your eyes to gently open if they were closed and you have vision. Joining us back in this sacred Zoom space room together, whether we're joining live or later. Really bowing to Hashem, to God, for this time together, the ability to have another day. Thank you. And thank you to you and your practice, showing up, taking refuge in the community of the Institute for Holiness, Kehilat Musar Mindfulness. I'm Rabbi Chassi Uriel Steinbauer, the director and founder of the Institute for Holiness. I'm so grateful that you join me weekly in these public offerings for us to practice, to take refuge, to work through the grief and loss of the genocide of October 7th, and to learn from our ancestors and God this whole year what the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, has to offer us, teach us on this path towards holiness, one day at a time. So I welcome you soon to look for Miketz, which will be coming, Bezrat Hashem, soon. And be sure to either read this week or on Shabbat, whether you join on Saturday, whether you join a community or not, for Minyan or in a synagogue to hear the Torah read. We will be covering the Parshat Vayigash. And so that will be this coming Saturday. The date will be 21st, 22nd, I think the 23rd. And then we'll be able, Bezrat Hashem, be able to cover Vayigash afterwards. So do read the Torah portion. Even I encourage you to read some of the commentators if you're able to, in whatever language you are able to study. And to hear it read out loud, it's such a gift to hear the laning of Torah, whether it's in person in a synagogue or a minyan or live on Zoom or on a YouTube channel elsewhere. We welcome your sponsorships for this program in memory of someone who has passed. May their memory be for a blessing. Or in honor of someone who is living that you want to cherish and honor. So we thank you for your donations. We thank you for subscribing to our mailing list at kehilatmusar.com. For those of you who want to actually join the community and join a Musar Mindfulness VAD so that you can learn and practice, just reach out to us and be in touch. All the information is at the website. And do subscribe to the YouTube channel. Thank you again, and I look forward to practicing and seeing you soon.